we're going to just... I'm just going to present a few things that I found relevant in this new paper that LaRouche wrote. Is the U.S. Congress dying before our eyes?
Yeah.
The baby doomers? It's in this week's EIR. And, yeah, there's also in here something I mentioned last week in a briefing I did, Lyndon LaRouche's transcript for the town hall meeting in Los Angeles. Presentation and a question and answer period with some members of our youth movement in Los Angeles, California, a town hall meeting that was sponsored by a Democratic Party club in the LA County State Democratic Party. And it's a very honest assessment of what the current political situation is. Because as we're discussing, as the discussion tonight has developed, it's become more increasingly clear that the political responsibility and the political mission, which our movement particularly represents, but the general characteristic of where we are historically requires that it's the young adult generation that takes upon the leadership to bring forth the long-term solutions for the world crisis today. I'm going to get into why that is. Why it is that, in principle, the political change that's necessary in the world can only be led by young people. So that was the nature of this discussion that Lyndon LaRouche had about 2 weeks ago in Los Angeles. And then I just recently produced a very important, very loving paper here on the baby doomers. But I'll just read the preface, and then I have a short clip that I wanted to show. Unfortunately, there's no audio. So I'll just narrate it, but here's the preface. Is the U.S. Congress dying before our eyes? The baby boomers. The rush by some poorly advised members of the U.S. Senate from both sides of the aisle in support of former Vice President Al Gore's and Newt Gingrich's global warming hoax suggests a self-inflicted early doom now threatening the continued existence of our USA. What has been pouring in and out of the U.S. Senate and from presently woe-begotten ranks of the would-be presidential pre-candidates during the recent weeks can be fairly described as an outbreak of a form of mass insanity comparable to the early 18th century John Law-style bubbles, or either the flagellants of Europe's 14th century New Dark Age. The current U.S. president is mentally ill, while the vice president is purely evil and, well, seemingly hordes from the ranks of the Senate are racing like fabled lemmings toward... No, it's okay. It's just going to take forever.
Okay.
What are you doing?
You know what I was going to do there.
While seemingly hordes from the ranks of the Senate are racing like fabled lemmings toward the waiting rocks below. Therefore, sociologists, historians, economists, and ordinary citizens alike must ask themselves, what actually happened to the minds of the section of the white-collar class which was born between the end of the war in 1945 and the shock effect of the deep post-war recession of 1957 through 1961? What turned that white-collar class of the post-war generation into what it has become today largely, something like a mass of maddened lemmings, which have been rushing to the cliffs since the latest extremely inconvenient outburst of malicious lying from babbling Al Gore. Okay, I'm not... Anybody familiar with lemmings at all? Ever watch the Nature Channel and see how these animals behave?
Not really.
No? Not really. This is the first time I've seen them myself. I've always heard Mr. LaRouche make reference to them in his papers, particularly on the subject of the baby boomer generation and their behavior. But from a clinical standpoint, he's absolutely correct. And I say that after about 4 years of political organizing in the population all around the United States and up here in Canada, and also in the U.S. Congress. What this phenomena is, the sociological phenomena of lemming-like madness among the baby boomers. So here's a quick clip. It's pretty
fair. Your internet is not coming.
What's that?
Yeah, that your internet is out of
connection. No, it should be connected. Oh, no.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, it should.
But you refresh?
Yeah, do back maybe?
And there's also a pop-up blocker.
Hold on a second. We'll just wait for it.
There's a pop-up blocker?
I think you might need to refresh it. Oh, wait.
Okay. Pop-up block.
So, I'll just do a little narrating.
How big
here.
Are they?
They don't look too big. They probably look probably about...
Squirrel size?
Prairie dogs.
Prairie dogs?
Yeah, very small.
Oh.
Rodent-like. They do. They run in packs. Usually don't see these things roaming around. You know, the guy is talking about how these lemmings just are persistent in pushing forward. Even they run into bodies of water in rivers, but they continue to swim through these bodies of water in rivers to get to the other side in order to just keep on moving forward, just to keep on going. Huh. So what they're doing now is they're getting toward their own destiny here, of the cliffs, of these, of the rocky shore. And these lemmings just continue to keep forward as the global financial system disintegrates and the lower 80% of the population continues to be destroyed under globalization. The lemmings continue to push forward with their... and now they're met with fate here, where there's a moment where they can make a decision to turn back and reverse the policies of the last 30 years. So one after another, they decide to plunge themselves like into
the wall.
Yeah.
Can I swim? My God. Oh.
Did they survive that?
One by one.
That's suicide.
They can swim.
Is it suicide or...
Well, I haven't looked into them, what they do, but as the narrator describes, their mission is just to keep moving forward. So they go, now once they see this as just another body of water, and they continue to move forward to try to push to the other end of the shore. And at a certain point, exhaustion kicks in, and these lemmings begin to become just small, divided corpses along the shore.
Food. Wow, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what drives these lemmings, but it's a good... it's a good comparison, sociologically, between what we're dealing with the baby boomer generation, because you got to understand that that's the generation of political leadership today, primarily in the United States and Europe. That's currently leading civilization toward hell, and they continue to tolerate the mass insanity of what Al Gore and the financiers who control the current world financial system represent. This is our fight, because what Matt was describing earlier, the world is bankrupt right now. And what we're seeing in the case of Al Gore is really, really the worst expression of baby boomer degeneracy that I've seen. I've seen even comparable to Bush. It's a little bit hard right now in my own mind to make a distinction what's worse, but I know that Bush is clinically insane. So I do take that into account. The problem with Al Gore is he's a person who's guilty of malicious intent in what he does. What I thought I was going to do earlier in the week was just dig through some of the material that we got. We put this pamphlet out. I'm not actually sure when it was published. Probably 1999. Probably 1999. It was during the 2000 presidential campaign. 1999-2000. When we were describing what the implications of an Al Gore presidency would be.
So the LaRouche movement had already labeled or targeted Al Gore.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you've seen the EIR site, but let's see. But we've got a whole dossier on Gore.
You're missing a W.
You need one more W.
That we pulled together, particularly now.
Jerry, if you want to try function F5, you might have both screens. You can look what you're doing.
Okay, thanks.
Try it again.
Brother.
Just keep doing until you get what you want.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just the F5 key. Okay. Alright, this is the website, the EIR website. But, yeah, we did target. Al Gore is not somebody who we decided just to identify. Because of some... No, it's here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
here it is. Alright. So we've got articles here, and, unfortunately, there's so much material, I just really didn't have time to go through all of this. But, Al Gore is no stranger to the LaRouche Youth Movement. Political movement. And the list goes on. So he's very well aware of who we are. We're very well aware of who he is. And most people that we're meeting in the streets discussing this, what he's up to right now, really don't understand who he is or what his background entails. For now, I'll leave it up to you guys to do some of that investigative work, dig through our files, find out a little bit more of what we're dealing with in terms of Gore specifically. But I want to hit at some of the things that we're is being discussed right now in terms of the system that Gore represents and what is the real threat to the existence of civilization if this madness has continued to be tolerated. Because we are at a point where the financial system is disintegrating. And there are various fronts that went through where the intention, there's two battles being fought right now in one war from two sides. One is the front that's being led by LaRouche on this question of the four nation strategy. The United States, Russia, India, and China. And these being the pillars of world leadership that would begin to recruit to a reorganizing the world economic system and return back to the Franklin Roosevelt system, a model of the Bretton Woods system, an upgraded model of that post-war system and political economic outlook. On the other hand, you have what's primarily being run out of Britain right now in an attempt to consolidate absolute globalization over the world economy. And this is being run primarily through the hedge fund activity right now, which is currently hoarding a large supply of the world's raw materials and resources. Precious metals, industrial materials, things like that. So that's the fight, but on a larger scale, it is this question of oligarchism, an oligarchical outlook on how what the existence of civilization is going to be as opposed to a Republican outlook. It starts there, and all of the particulars fall under that banner. Because that has been the fight for the last 200 to 300 years in the English-speaking world. That has been the central fight. The issue of oligarchism and empire versus the institution of a sovereign nation state, republican system of government. And if you begin to look at history from that standpoint, particularly political history, then you begin to see what the fight is, and more what we represent as a political movement. Because we're not against Al Gore because he made this movie. He has a larger role in a much bigger operation that's being run to destroy the nation state. And the economic policies that are attached to this environmental scheme do have that intent to lock nations up in a zero technological, zero industrial mode of economic development, which effectively is what he admittedly says, control of population growth and essentially reduction. Because Al Gore, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, represents an outlook. Well, he's right now the advisor on climate change, the climate advisor to the British government. He was brought in 2007, January, really? By the Chancellor, Gordon Brown. And Al Gore also runs a hedge fund out of London.
He's the advisor on climate change where?
To London. Yeah, to Britain. 2007, he was brought in by the Chancellor to hold that position. And
what is the Chancellor in Britain?
Lower than Prime Minister.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. and above a governor or two. Almost like a vice president, chancellor, military, I don't know, something there. Military advisor or something, I don't know. But that's interesting. I didn't know that. So, that's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. And his environmental roots are very much influenced by the British oligarchy, Prince Philip, Prince Charles. And as we got reports on previous EIRs and the historical legacy of what created environmentalism, which is documented in a pretty extensive article by one of our Canadian youth members, Rob Ainsworth, who did a research study on this. Mm-hmm. But what he had effectively coming from the British Roundtable was a conspiracy organized the idea in that came from a guy named Cecil Rhodes, who was one of the heads of the British Roundtable. The idea was that obviously their outlook was the English blood is genetically superior than the darker skin or non-English, non-Anglo races, so-called species. And so the idea was that we need, from the British Roundtable, was that we need to begin to basically conquer as much territory as we can, conquer as much land area on the planet to create a higher potential for a larger expansion of English blood. And this is integral with the colonial outlook of the more historic roots of the British, what Dave was discussing earlier in terms of the British East India Company, the British East Africa trading companies. And from there, a pseudoscience called eugenics was launched, race science, where a society was organized to do these studies on people of different races. And various different things were taken into consideration. The whole...
It's interesting. It brings to mind another discussion I had on the campus.
Okay, sure.
Interjected. It's kind of interesting. I was organizing this kid, and we were going through a question of what makes one an environmentalist. What I posed to him was the fact that in order to be an environmentalist, you actually had to understand something about the environment, which meant you had to go out there and investigate the environment. You couldn't remain in a nice air-conditioned room in a university wearing Birkenstocks and drinking fair trade coffee and claim that you cared for the environment. You actually had to interact with the environment and talk to some trees and engage in dialogue and so forth. I told him if he was serious about being an environmentalist, I knew a great environmentalist in history that he should investigate. I told him, Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo da Vinci was passionate about the environment. He went out, he studied
nature.
He took measurements. He studied the golden section. He looked into the growth processes of plants. So I was like, look, you should be as rigorous and as mm-hmm. passionate about the environment as da Vinci. You should become a scientist. And, we got to this back and forth. Went on for a little while, but needless to say, by the end of the discussion, the kid says, "Well, look, I think the people who've contributed the most to helping save the environment are those people in Africa who've never gotten access
to this terrible technology. I was like, you mean those who were dying off? He's like, yeah, because, they never put up these coal plants. They never, they don't waste because they have nothing.
I just looked at the kids. I was like,
it's out
there.
Yeah. That's
very interesting.
That's exactly where
it's
goes.
An interesting concept of environmentalism. The more we die off, the better the environment thrives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was the agenda of the
Africans who are dying off are the best environmentalists that can be found. They're not, they're just wasting away. They're not consuming. They're not growing. They're not procreating.
When the last ones died, you could put up a big statue, which could be in the middle of your town when you move in.
Yeah.
To the great African environmentalist.
Yeah, this is his image of the environmentalist. Starving African child. Great
environmentalist.
Yeah.
It was born. Well,
it's
like
a family
thing. They're born.
These things are very clinical. I mean, when you get out there and you organize people and you start, you push the limits of the argument to a point where they actually reveal what they're actually thinking. Well, it won't come out in just casual discussion. Just keep pushing. You find that underneath all these layers of so-called liberalism and so forth is actually an idea which is absolutely fascist. Yeah. Something you said just triggered that thought in my mind. I got a good chuckle out of it. Ironically enough, the only thing you can do in those circumstances is laugh at the person until they become self-conscious of the things they do.
They're so stupid.
They're just more or less gave themselves away. Al Hitler, hold it back
with me. Well, it's the same outlook. It's the same outlook as the British, because that was their notion of conservation.
Sure.
That we would protect the environment from the mismanagement of these inferior race species who couldn't culturally or intellectually sustain industrial society. So therefore, we had to protect the environment from being destroyed and the resources from being used up by these people who didn't actually know what to do with them, because they were genetically and culturally inferior. And this is the same thing that came out of Henry Kissinger. A policy he wrote in the 1970s, a National Security Study, Memorandum 200, which called for that same treatment toward Africa on the question of raw materials. So this was the orientation which launched the so-called science of eugenics and environmentalism. And it came directly out of the British Round Table. And also, I haven't got a chance to read all of them, but there's a few articles in the EIR which go through the history of the fact that the Nazis were actually very much green before they turned brown. They're heavily environmentalists, especially Hermann Göring. But there's articles that go through that. I think he was the forestry minister of Germany. But they wanted to eradicate every non-German plant in
Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Green Auschwitz too. Where's
politics? Yeah, but this is where it comes from. We've traced where this is run out of as an open conspiracy from the British Round Table through the Eugenics Society which later became the same circles around something that I'll touch upon just shortly, the Congress for Cultural Freedom. But this was the cultural tendency and the political orientation of the British between World War I and World War II. This very heavy racist imperial outlook. And one of the things that we also figured out was that studies for environmentalism were heavily funded by the same financial institutions who were putting up money to sponsor Hitler's rise to power. One of the good things to note is that in the personality of Franklin Roosevelt was an individual who very much understood this aspect of the way in which the British operate financially and politically. He was a man who was willing to stare this empire down and use the power that we had in the United States to shape world politics in the middle of this war on fascism in World War II. It was due to the fact that the United States is a fundamentally different system of government that allowed us to be mobilized under a Roosevelt presidency and the collaborators of Franklin Roosevelt to begin to get the gears of industry and the gears of economic development moving as soon as he came into the presidency. There was a top-down mobilization for a development of the United States industrially to build the United States out of the Great Depression, and actually to have a good neighbor policy toward the rest of the Americas, and share the same fruit of labor and production. That was Roosevelt's orientation, and it was through the policies of the Roosevelt presidency that gave us the capability, when called upon, to mobilize this economic base for wartime production, which was the key driver in World War II, and also the decisive factor in the actual winning of that war, defeating fascism, was the pure, raw industrial power and output of the U.S. physical economy, which is transformed from pre-war development to wartime production on a large scale to produce the logistics to fight the war when we were called upon. It's that cultural and political aspect of the United States political system that the British vehemently hate still to this day. And they did everything in their power to destroy any remnants of Roosevelt's legacy once he had passed on. The United States was an advanced economy at that period, 1945, 1946, when we were pushing the agenda for the Bretton Woods Conference, setting up the United Nations, and establishing this whole post-war economic system. At that point, we were the most productive economy on the planet that had ever been achieved in history. So we were in a leading position to exert our leadership and authority on certain questions of cooperation, etc. But does anybody know why the momentum that Roosevelt initiated his prospect toward a post-war world economic system? Does anybody know why that intention began to die out at a certain point?
What that?
Particularly around the 1960s, mid-1960s.
Well, he died.
Later 1960s. Yeah.
Right? And then it was an intention. It was an intention to destroy that. Was it not?
It was.
Like some very quick things happened with relationship with like Japan and other countries that you're talking about this, you know, having good relationships with your neighbors and sharing the wealth of production. I mean, those types of initiatives were changed after Roosevelt's death.
Yeah, they began to lose their intensity. They were maintained to a certain degree through the Eisenhower presidency, then later on under Kennedy. But they took a big turn right after Roosevelt's death, when Truman came in.
Truman.
Because that's when
bombs got dropped.
Yeah, which would have never happened had Roosevelt lived. That would never take place.
Why would it make a difference if he was alive or not? Like, he didn't have power. I mean.
Who's that?
Roosevelt.
Well, he did.
What do you mean he didn't have power?
Like, what type of power he had?
Roosevelt?
After his presidency.
Well, if he... Oh, after his presidency.
Yeah, he... Keep in mind, he didn't. He never had a post-presidency political career.
Yeah.
He died in office in the first few months of his fourth term. He served four presidential terms, 12 years, as president of the United States.
It was after that they put in the two-term limit.
Mm-hmm.
Coincidence?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was a guy...
Before, like, until him... President could just keep getting reelected. Now you can serve a maximum of two terms.
Mm-hmm.
We changed the law, you know?
Not exactly, no. I do not. No.
But I mean, as president, it would have been his decision whether or not to drop those bombs, wouldn't it? Like,
yeah, I'm
to
not
a large degree.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's also ironic that the plans in terms of the development of the prototypes, they were experimental bombs that weren't actually intended to be dropped. They were in motion as Roosevelt was still alive. They were kept secret from his vice president Truman. When Truman took hold of the office, he had no idea we had a nuclear weapons program.
Truman didn't know?
No, Truman had no idea. And upon Roosevelt's death, he was actually briefed for the first time on. You know, it's like, you know, this great toy, right? Ooh, yeah, nuclear weapon.
But Roosevelt, did they Roosevelt know?
Oh, Roosevelt knew, absolutely. But they kept...
There was a separation of things.
Yeah, they kept it secret.
Do you think that's the way it should be?
In this particular case, absolutely.
But I mean, in general, because...
Whether a vice president should be kept... have been kept abreast of certain...
Of certain military initiative or...
It still begs more investigation, but one thing that we know to some extent from looking at the historical record is that
the person that should have been brought in as Roosevelt's vice president, something that I'm still working through in terms of the history, was a fellow by the name of Henry Wallace, who represented an outlook which was very, very much in line with Roosevelt. In certain cases, has even been argued to have been more progressive than Roosevelt on questions of civil rights, and specifically identifying this problem of what was referred to then as Senecism. This very same disease was described in the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. And there was a big operation to move Henry Wallace out of the way to ensure that he did not get the vice presidential nomination. Which is interesting to look at, and there's the subsequent speeches after Truman comes into office by Wallace, in which he attacks Truman for the process he sets in motion. Remember, Truman invites Churchill into Fulton, Missouri, to give what is probably the defining speech of the post-Roosevelt era, which is the Iron Curtain speech. A famous speech in which, he defines essentially the boundaries for the Cold War. Churchill, he gives a speech in Fulton, Missouri, which is in Truman's backyard.
What's Fulton? How do you spell Fulton?
F-U-L-T-O-N. And but this whole history is very interesting in spirit. And if you look at how this process was unleashed, it becomes very obvious the fact that the British moved very quickly upon Roosevelt's death to ensure that the kind of post-war perspective he had, which was primarily to end colonialism. What Roosevelt argued was that we have to end these 18th century British methods. In other words, what we wish to do in the post-war period is liberate nations from colonialism. We want to use American technology to develop the rest of the world. That was his outlook.
For American ways.
American way, which primarily means non-machine tool capability and so forth, put to the use of developing industrial states all over the world. Churchill and the Anglo-American establishment had a very different view. Their view was that in the post-war period, they would move back in and recolonize the majority of the world. So there was a fundamental conflict. And one thing which if you study the British carefully, is also the fact that they've always hated the historical relationship between the United States and Russia. Mm-hmm. And the position of Henry Wallace, the position of FDR and so forth, was that the Russians were better off dealing with the Russians, who we had a historical relationship with going back to Lincoln in helping liberate the serfs in Russia prior to even liberating the slaves in the United States. Huh. And the Russians also helped us in the time of the Civil War against the British. Huh. Very few people know. Mm-hmm. But their idea was that we're better off collaborating with the Russians in the post-war period than collaborating with the British, who've been our historical enemies. And Wallace makes this very clear if you read his speeches. This idea of an Anglo-American special relationship, which is what Churchill began touting as the strategic outlook of the United States, was insane. We don't want an Anglo-American empire. We want one of the world of sovereign nation states. When you begin to look at this question of the dropping of the bomb as really a means of reorganizing the geopolitical structure in Europe, because the dropping of the bomb redefines world relations for about 50. I mean, we're still in the Cold War to a certain extent. People sometimes don't look at it, but when you look at the Bush administration address Russia, there are Cold War undertones to most of what's stated. Mm-hmm. And the world has been paralyzed since approximately 1946 by the actions that were perpetrated at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It completely defined the entire post-war period. So all these things that were anticipated in terms of the freedom and liberation of nations in sub-Saharan Africa, the transformation of the economic conditions in Latin America and Southwest Asia, and all over Eurasia generally, were put on hold. Because now you had these great superpowers, each with these super weapons, kind of, you know, in this kind of cowboy-like standoff, and the world, the entire world.
But also the very act of dropping the bomb.
Sure, it was meant to.
Was something that
terrorized nations.
The world has not seen before or since.
Sure, it was a terrorist act.
Great.
The idea was that by dropping these bombs, you would terrify nations into either submitting or falling in line.
Yep.
And it was known. It was absolutely known by Churchill. It was known by the people who were manipulating Truman. Truman was largely an idiot, and if you read his biography, you get a very good sense of how small-minded this guy was. He's largely manipulated. Yeah. He's either evil or he's manipulated.
They can't take Brian Mulroy.
Maybe both. You know? On the strategic level, that's where these guys were going. On the cultural level, what the British establishment made very clear was that in the post-war period, they would largely attack two questions. One was the question of the authoritarian personality, which is this notion that an individual leader can actually direct a process. It's essentially the argument that anyone who says they know the truth is a fascist. And the other question which they raise as...
It's
the idea of the... What they said was that we have to destroy the notion of the authoritarian personality. So they conducted studies to essentially make the argument that despite the fact that Americans thought they had some higher moral ideals and say the Germans, that fundamentally Americans were just as fascist as the Germans. And there's a whole set of studies associated with this idea of the authoritarian personality, but the fundamental basis of getting a population to attack the idea that anyone who says they hold the truth or can understand universal truths are fascists. They're as fascist as Hitler was. They're as fascist, if you really dig down to the roots, as fascist as, quite frankly, Christ was, as Socrates was, and as anybody who's ever asserted that they can understand universal truth. So you had a fundamental attack on Judeo-Christian values. And what these guys described was the fact that we had to put an end to what they refer to as the Age of Pisces and usher in the Age of Aquarius, which is, you know, the age of the Dionysian cult of sex and violence, in a certain sense. But the attack on the authoritarian personality was immediately launched after the death of Roosevelt. And the other aspect which Bertrand Russell represented was this idea of the using mass psychology as a new weapon to enslave the majority of the world. What he argued in The Impact of Science and Society was that mass psychology would become the greatest weapon in the post-war period. They unleashed this stuff like crazy. Mm-hmm. You look at the popular literature around from the time around 44 on. Right? I don't know about you guys, but I had a very interesting experience when I was in the 10th grade in the United States, because they really do a job on this. You come out of the 9th grade and you're all optimistic about the world, you set up these ideals and so forth. And around the 10th grade, you get hit with all this existentialist literature.
Sophomore grade, eh?
Huh?
Sophomore.
Yeah, sophomore. Mm-hmm. They hit you with 1984 by George Orwell.
Mm-hmm. I went to high school in the States.
They hit you with The Lord of the Flies.
Yeah. Lord of the Flies.
By William Golding.
Yeah.
And
the British intelligence. British naval intelligence.
Piece?
Huh? They hit you with Animal Farm. They hit you with every form of existentialist
gibberish. They did all of that in grade 10 here.
The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley. I read so much crap in the 10th grade, you wouldn't imagine. And it completely turns young people pessimistic about the nature of man. Now, if you look at
Catcher in the Rye?
Catcher in the Rye, yes. I read that in 10th grade. Mm-hmm. Now, the shape your world outlook. Yeah. Now look at when these things are actually composed and written. Look at 1984. What's 1984 about? It's interesting because Orwell is also he's British intelligence. He's doing work in the India theater. All of these guys who are composing these pieces are British intelligence. Orwell was British intelligence. Golding was British intelligence. Huxley is old school British intelligence. What they do is they shape a world outlook, which is intended to define the post-war era. 1984 is actually a play. It's describing conditions was anticipated in 1948.
Yeah.
So it's a switcheroo, right? Mm-hmm. 1984 versus 48.
Yeah.
And they're describing what they're... So it's the idea of science fiction. Science fiction was created to get you to begin to accept a reality which is inevitable.
Yeah.
That's what science fiction is about, which is what just about every major British oligarch writes science fiction. They say, well, this is where the world is going, and you must adapt to it.
Yeah.
Get used to it. And if you go through this whole question, and there's also funny stuff you can dig into if you read 1984. I mean, I don't know if it's a coincidence that one of the main characters is named Winston. There's all these little references over you can dig out. But the whole idea was to shape the post-war culture. And this generation referred to as baby boomers are largely people who were brought into an environment which was controlled psychologically.
Yeah,
the idea was to create a generation which would not condone another Roosevelt, another so-called authoritarian personality, which is really just a code word for anyone who's concerned about the development of mankind. The whole post-war period, and this
doesn't that method turn itself on its ass? I mean, because you create. Then people aren't capable of having leaders at all.
The idea is this, right? If you say to anyone, right, this is the classic attack on LaRouche. It's what I got when I got interested in LaRouche. Well, LaRouche is an authoritarian personality. He says he knows the truth. But Hitler said he knew the way. No? He's a fascist. He's got to be a fascist because he says that he can understand how the universe operates. Yeah. Let's imagine that we accept that idea. We say that no one can actually understand how the universe functions. And no one can actually approximate universal truth. Then what becomes the basis for organizing relationships in society? Opinion. I have an opinion, you have an opinion, he has an opinion. None of us obviously can hold universal truth, because were we to hold universal truth, we'd be fascists, obviously. And surely I don't want to impose my will on you, because that'd be violating your rights to your opinion. So therefore, every relationship becomes one that says that we have to agree to disagree. So-and-so says, I like eating babies alive. I said, well, that's really unfortunate, but you have a right to your opinion. I have my opinion on these things. And meanwhile, the baby's halfway down his throat. But that's the nature of this stuff, right? So what you do is you create a society in which people become incapable of actually establishing a standard of morality. People become immoral by virtue of the fact that there is, by default, precisely. And what becomes dominant in society is the extent to which you can mass orchestrate mass popular opinion. That's how you lead people. You don't put forth a Führer, you don't put forth an authoritarian personality. You get people to believe that they're forming their own opinions about how the universe works. No one makes up their own mind in the society they want to create. people think they're making up their own minds about everything. It's like, well, I wear these clothes because I like them. No, there's a bunch of fashion designers in Milan who 2 years before you get your hands on that pair of jeans have determined what you're going to do. The choices you're given are pre-designed for you to pick among pre-selected choices. That's the way stuff works. So the idea of that's the idea of mass psychology. That's how you control people.
Or control is
So in a certain sense, the only people that can pierce through this veil are people who have an ability to actually understand causes and actually get a sense of how this stuff works. So what I was describing earlier is this question of the oligarchical principle. I mean, how do oligarchs do what they do? How does a handful of people control the overwhelming majority of the world's population?
They have to be pretty clever.
When I was a student.
But even lots of clout, I mean, it's got to be.
Yeah, you get a lot of people backing you. You can really make people believe.
Yeah, but
you want to believe.
Yeah. But I mean, I think what you're describing is something that's pre that situation.
But it's because
if it's just clout, then it's too obvious, right?
No, of course. There's an interesting question. There's a twofold question to this, which is one, which I posed to myself the moment I got a smell for this oligarchism thing before I ran into LaRouche. I asked myself, how is it that we're so dumb as a majority, that we could be dominated for so long by people who inbreed aren't necessarily the smartest people in the world. How does this work? I mean, they couldn't possibly be that intelligent.
It's a system that's been in place for a long time, for generations and generations.
I mean, why does it work?
Our parents just ingrained it into us when we were kids. And the same as, and for sure, as we are sitting here today, we're going to be doing the same thing to our kids. Because
well,
I disagree.
Because the whole idea of sitting here.
Well, maybe not us, but you know,
no,
the whole idea of sitting here is to try and break that.
Okay, well, let's try to figure out how to do it. How do you corrupt someone?
Corrupt them again.
You have to get them before the age of
12. What's a...
Make them see gray and they're black and white?
I don't know if you guys are prone to reading classical literature, but there's a fellow who had a very good insight into this problem. British fellow, Shakespeare. In his plays, he spends a lot of time trying to give people a window into how this stuff works. It's oligarchical principle works. And there's a particular play of his that I've always enjoyed, which is named Othello. Story of this Negro military, this Moor, military commander, who's an absolute genius in military affairs, but a complete idiot when it comes to question of psychology and questions of getting at first causes. There's absolutely no scientific method, but he's brave, he's steadfast, he's resolute, he's committed to warfare. And Shakespeare designs his character, Iago, whose sole purpose is to psychologically destroy this guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Iago operates in a very interesting way. I mean, I'm not going to give away the thing, because you guys should read it if you haven't already read it. But Iago is operating on a psychological profile. He looks at the Moor, and he tells very quickly the fact that the guy's a mystic. He's superstitious. He's got no ability
perform basic analytical thinking and is prone to trust in people without them necessarily earning his trust. And based upon that profile, he psychologically destroys this guy to the point where he takes the life of his wife and his own by the end of the play. And he tells you step by step, it's more or less of an instruction manual in a certain sense, of how you can psychologically destroy someone who has no ability to actually understand the principle of evil. And obviously it's a tragedy for that, for that particular reason, man. But Shakespeare is operating in an environment in which this is what's happening. It's a lesson in statescraft. And Schiller does a similar thing in his play The Dossier. There it's even more complex because
Schiller.
Yeah, Schiller, The Dossier.
The Dossier?
Yeah.
Dossier.
The Dossier.
Bertrand Russell saying that before you then if you don't start to
they'll indoctrinate them, yeah. And the ghost here gets even more interesting because they're and both of them are attacks on Venice, which is actually where a lot of this British stuff comes from, the Venetian establishment. In the ghost here, there's a slightly different scenario, but there you have a German prince who goes to Venice, and the weakness of the prince, which the Venetian establishment preys on, is the fact that he has a poor education. He wishes to appear as if he knows quite a bit, but he has a poor education and therefore is prone to things mystical. So they run a series of operations on the guy. The first is to indoctrinate him in the occult. So because he doesn't know whether there's any truth or not, he's fascinated by things that seem to be magical. So if you know, the more you draw him into things that are of a mystical nature, the more he gets sucked in. And they run a switch on him, where the moment he gets indoctrinated and really sucked into the mysticism, they allow him to discover the fact that they've been running an operation on him. And then what happens to the German prince is he becomes overconfident in his intellectual ability. He says, aha, I've discovered the fact that I was being, that they were pulling one on me. So now I get it. And he gets overconfident in his intellect. So he becomes very arrogant about his ability to smoke out operations and to decipher evil and so forth. And then they suck him right in. Next thing you know, the guy's reading Enlightenment philosophy and he's hanging out with the high society crowd and so forth. And needless to say, by the end of the story, they completely destroy this guy. He's up to his ears in debt. He's gone. He's essentially a slave to Venice.
Is the mass psychology thing they call the Illuminati? Some get confused and call it the Illuminati.
No, you can call it all kinds of things. I think the way Lynn looks at it probably is it's as sane as you'll get. If you get into the Illuminati thing, it can get kind of strange. Some of the stuff, I mean, there are secret societies, there are Freemasonic circles and so forth, but they're not as, they operate within a larger epistemological. What you gotta get to the root axioms. You gotta figure out what are the fundamental belief structures of this establishment and how you poke at it. You gotta get a sense of what this stuff is. What are the axioms this is built upon? And you know, people like Shakespeare, Schiller, and so forth have a very keen understanding of how this stuff works. And this stuff is not, you know, it's not simply for entertainment. These are people who are involved in a fight to save republics. And back then, if you know anything about the Globe Theater, the way to educate a population largely was, at least in Republican circles, was always through the arts. So you had to infuse into the arts a message that would allow people to gain an insight into the mind of their oppressor.
So this is the kind of work we have to involve ourselves in, because if we're serious about defeating evil, we gotta get serious. We laugh about it often. I was telling my friend Matt the other day. He brought in volumes of H.G. Wells' Outlines on History, and I was laughing at this thing. You gotta think about how committed these guys are to their world designs, that they would sit around and rewrite the history of the world such that they could indoctrinate people in this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's somewhat
kind
remarkable
of,
that
kind
people
of
would be that committed to evil.
Well, it is. It boggles the mind, like where the drive comes from, like what
power, greed.
What inspires people to.
To destroy people.
To work so hard to believe what's false.
Yeah. Right. And you look around you and you find, you know.
I had the opportunity of being very close to a mind like that. Got involved in high finance. Actually sat down with me. I mean, after sort of ascertaining that he's responsible for making decisions on literally billions of dollars, his next sentence is, "I don't affect anything. I have no effect."
Yeah.
And I was just like, I didn't know where to start. I mean, it's just like, well, I'm not in high finance, so I can't really prove
maybe
it to you on that level, but
no clue.
What about the family?
Yeah, exactly.
Just no connection.
No,
just numbers on a screen.
This
I'm sorry,
that's
too
cool.
Thanks.
See you around next time.
That's the problem.
Boston.
Yeah, are you taking off?
Tomorrow.
Have a good trip. Are you coming back anytime soon?
I
don't
know.
Is that it?
Yeah, I gotta go feed, you know?
Okay, well, maybe I'll get down to Boston before that happens.
Okay. Now I gotta consider it. When am I going to see you on the streets? I'm going to be out here alone, man. I'm going to need you.
That's true. Yeah, Dave's holding another 40. He's going to need a lot of help. That's true.
So,
you don't want these crazy. You don't want these Canadian environmentalists.
Are you going to be around?
Huh?
Are you going
to
be around?
Good. About 2 or 3 months.
Okay. Ciao, guys.
All right. Take care.
Very nice meeting you.
See you.
Watch out for Al Gore.
Washroom. Yeah. Right in the back. Yep, should go. Not that many rooms, can't miss.
Okay. I guess I'll see you on the streets too, right?
Somewhere. I don't know where you
are. Somewhere,
oh.
If you see him on the
I live right here.
What's going on here?
In the cubbyhole. In the back.
Does that work?
Huh?
What's in there?
Toilet?
Yeah.
You can use it. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, the light. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Don't get scared.
Okay.
Yep.
The thing you said about Schiller and Shakespeare, who wanted to teach the society with
art,
values with art.
Yeah.
That's coming from a Platonic philosophical point of view, right?
Sure. But it's interesting. If you spend some time, I don't know how much you're into the fine arts, but Lin once made a funny statement, which I pondered over for weeks, so that every great piece of art is a political cartoon.
Who said
that? This is Lin, a while back.
Yeah.
Doesn't really make much sense. But then you take some time and you look at the works of, say, Goya. You figure out what exactly the guy is doing.
Goya?
Yeah, Francisco Goya. You have his works in the bed. You should pick it up. He's in around the time of the American Revolution. Great artist. Huh? But everything he does is intended to give the population. And it's not always overt, because you got to remember, a lot of these artists were operating under monarchy, and they were relatively brutal. So they're constantly dropping hints in their works of art to give the population an ability to understand the nature of what they're confronting with. That's the nature of art. I mean, anything which is supposedly art, which is not intended, on raising the ability of people to think at a higher level, is useless. Very much. And you can go tell that to art students, and they go crazy. But I wish to express myself. Well, what are you going to express?
Well, I don't know. It's whatever I feel.
Say that.
That could get pretty messy.
Thank you, man.
This is what you do. We got it. So Plato had this concept of scarce people.
So when are you guys doing this again?
We're doing it next Thursday, but we're also doing it every evening.
Yeah, oh really? Something going on,
A lot of free time is one of those things I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I'll be getting into in the next couple of weeks and writing my insurance exam.
Okay.
Do you realize that as human beings we can actually create time?
As well as
I know that. I know that.
I'm so busy I work beyond time. Time does not exist to me. I do more in
the day
that most people will not even consider doing it in a week. I'm always.
We can
training you're in right now. You know.
You can always find your way you're at.
No, I'm really inspired by the meeting we had tonight. So yes. And then I was myself, so I know exactly what was transpired here.
Good.
Very well involved. I'm glad that I ran into Matt.
Yeah. Is it? Definitely Thursday nights, keep them free. And anytime in between that you find that time to be free. This is possibly the only movement that's touching on the things that you're going to hear tonight.
For sure. When I first came across the book, for instance, roughly a year ago, and I've actually been, I think I went to the website once.
I'll send you. I'll send you a couple classes by email too.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Right?
I don't get to check my email very often. That's
in 2 weeks, but
okay.
So, yeah. It's very nice.
His name is David.
David.
Yeah. David's actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Goes back a few hundred years.
Uh huh. Good.
Thanks very much, Matt.
Yeah, no problem.
See you soon, John.
Yeah.
Jerry.
Yep.
Guillermo.
Yes. Like Guillermo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. Look for your boxing gloves in the mail.
Oh, did you get a copy of the magazine? Get in three? did you get an EIR? You picked it up, right? The magazine that we put out.
Yeah,
the EIR.
Oh, pick up some stuff.
Oh, here, you should grab one of these. Where's the last thing? Some of the good stuff in there.
Yeah,
okay. Perfect.
Cool. Thanks very much. Have a good night, guys.
All right. Good night. So, Jerry, where do we leave off, man? What were you touching on? I wanted to get closure. I felt like there was something left untouched. Mm-hmm. But
Dave picked it up on his question of post-war culture orientation and how that was organized and orchestrated, mm-hmm. what the intention was to do that.
Dave, you're not coming? This
guy's almost squeezed me at the border once. I want to go through that experience. My shiller really kicks in and I start getting all sweet. Border control.
Oh, man. That's some trouble.
The leftover Negro in me can't quite tolerate police interrogations for more than 15 minutes. It's not fun.
But are you staying with GP or something?
Yeah, I'll join those guys. Yeah. You probably use some life, so if you inject something. I have to use an oversized syringe to get something out of it. It'll be good. We'll have some fun. My boy Ilko's back, so.
Where's he?
Some fun Bulgarian adventures. He calls me.